Sahana bhavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavirnyan karavavahai, tejasvi navadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti. Narayanam namaskritya, Narayanam Naram Chaiva Narottamam, Naram Chaiva Devim Saraswatim Chaiva, Devim Sar Tato Jayamudirayet, Tato Dayam Pitamahadyam Pravadanti Shashtam, Pitamahadyam Pravadan Maharshi Makshaya Vibhuti Yuktam, Maharshi Makshaya Narayana Syam Shajameka Putram, Narayana Syam Shajamek Dvaipayanam Vedanadhim Namami, Dvaipayanam Vedanadhim Namami. Very good. Welcome back. We're continuing our study of the Moksha Dharma Parva, that section of Mahabharata where Yudhishthira receives so many wonderful spiritual teachings from Bhishma as Bhishma lies dying. We began this, this is chapter 175, and we began this discussion we began this chapter in the last class. And just to pick up the thread, I'll wait for everyone to be seated. And the chapter, as you remember, opened with Bhishma, Yudhishthira's question. And this is a very big change of subject matter. We've seen in a prior chapter so much discussion, prior chapter about karma, and before that a lot on death and dying and how to handle desire. And then in this chapter we find a very dramatic shift of subject matter. It becomes extremely philosophical with a discussion about where did all this come from? The chapter opens with Yudhishthira's question, where he says, Kutaha srishtam idam vishwam. From whom did this entire universe come forth? Jagat sthavara jangamam. This entire world made of things that are inert and sentient. Where did it all come from? Pralayecha kam abhyeti. And at the end of time, where will it all go? Tanme bruhi pitamaha. O grandfather, O Bhishma, please tell me all of this. So the chapter opens with Yudhishthira's question, and Bhishma's answer, if you remember, was to recount a dialogue between two very great rishis, the eldest being Bhrigu, and the younger one who is asking the questions is Bharadwaja. So Bhishma narrates the story. Bharadwaja approaches Bhrigu and asks these very same questions, the same questions that Yudhishthira has asked. These same questions were asked by Bharadwaja. And so what Bhishma then recounts is Bhrigu's response to Bharadwaja. And that's what we saw in the prior class. We just began. In fact, I've kind of felt bad. The class was mostly story, and that's not good. It's not satisfying if we have a class where it's mostly the story. Of course, Mahabharata is a huge story, and so you can't avoid that there's some storytelling engaged. But this is certainly not meant to be a storytelling class. We're taking Mahabharata, but not for the sake of the story, specifically, though, for the sake of the spiritual teachings embedded in the story. So that's what we want to see in today's class and future classes. We'll pick up the thread. We had just begun the 11th verse, where the unfoldment of who is the one from whom this universe has come forth. The prior verse, verse 10, evam bhagavan prashtaha bharadwajena samshayam. Bhrigu, being thus asked by Bharadwaja, then Maharshihi Brahma Sankashaha Sarvam Tasmai Tato Bravit, and then Bhrigu replies to Bharadwaja and clears his doubts, and that reply It's a reply both to the question of Bharadwaja and a reply to the question of Yudhishthira. That reply begins in verse 11, and we'll pick up the thread there. Manaso nama vikyataha, manaso nama shruta purvo maharshibhi, shruta purvo anadinadhano devas, anadinadhano tatha bhedyo jaramaraha, tatha bhedyo jaramaraha. And we began this discussion and then ran out of time because of something very odd. And that is, in describing the source of the universe, Bhrigu says, manasaha nama vikyataha. The source of the universe is vikyataha, well known as being manasa, literally of the mind. Manasa means that which comes from the mind is manasa. What an odd way to describe the origin of the universe. Manasa nama vikyataha. Shruta purvo maharshibhi, and this is what was understood long ago by all the great rishis, that source of the universe is anadi, beginningless, nidhana, without end, that deva, that god, tata abhedyaha, is partless, cannot be divided, ajara and amara, is without old age and death. Okay, this language is fairly simple, but the really surprising term was manasa. In what sense did the world come from mind? Now, there's actually two or three different ways of interpreting that. The commentator takes it one way, others will take it another way. Let's examine some of this. First of all, and this can get rather technical, and I'm going to do my best not to let it get too technical here. The commentator gets extremely technical on this point. In what sense is the world manasa? Let's translate that now as born of mind. Manasa, born of mind. And in examining that, maybe we need to go back to, If I can use the expression Vedanta 101. Vedanta 101 means, how do we understand creation from a Vedantic perspective? How did the rishis describe creation in a more philosophical manner? Instead of saying, you know, Bhagavan created the world, how did they describe that? Well, some of you will remember in other classes, we've gone through an analysis of how creation takes place. In that analysis, we identified the two primary factors, and hopefully many of you will remember those two factors. Let's see what that is. It's just... Thank you. We said the two main factors were, and I'll just define these terms in a moment, the terms used, upadana karana and nimitta karana. Upadana karana will translate as material cause. And nimitta karana, often translated as efficient cause, except no one knows what that word means. Efficient, not in the sense of of modern English, but efficient is I guess Western philosophers must like that term. The term that is always called efficient, but it means with regard to knowledge. And we'll talk about this right now. All right. So we understand for any act of creation, there must be these two factors present as a minimum. There must be material stuff out of which anything is made, and there must also be the knowledge through which the creation takes place. And the scriptures, the usual metaphor they give is, in the creation of a pot, two factors are required. One is upadana karana, material cause, specifically clay, But that's not enough. If you give me a lump of clay and ask me to make a pot, suppose I have no idea what a pot is. Not likely. But suppose I live in a I've lived in a village where there are no pots. And you ask me to make a pot. What will I do? Obviously, there's a second factor required, and that is the knowledge, called nimitta karana, efficient cause. Without one or the other, no creation is possible. And this is true with regard to everything from the most simple to the most complex. Now, in understanding Bhagavan as the source of all, we're talking about the creator of the cosmos. We're not talking about the creator of a pot. So we have to draw some, we have to make some distinctions. Certainly, the God of the universe cannot be like a pot maker. Why? The pot maker is the possessor of the knowledge, nimitta karana. The knowledge is within the pot maker. What about the material? The material is not inside the pot maker. The material is outside. Now, we understand that the creator of all, in the beginning, there was only that one. Sadeva idam agra asit. The scriptures say, in the beginning was only that one, only the creator. Sadeva, truth, that divinity alone existed, which means there was no place to go for the material. And as you've probably heard from me or from some other teacher before, that means that in the case of the creator of the universe, unlike the pot maker had the knowledge inside, but the material outside, but the creator of the cosmos must have been the possessor of both the knowledge and the material. That is, the creator of all must be the abhinna nimitta upadana karana. Pardon me, long Sanskrit words. Abhinna, non-separate, simultaneous. Simultaneously, the nimitta karana, the efficient cause, the source of knowledge, and simultaneously the upadana karana, the source of the material. So how can we understand? The pot maker went outside for the material. Bhagavan could not have gone outside for the material. So other scriptures offer another metaphor. And the metaphor, I think this comes in Mundaka Upanishad, yatha urna nabihi, is my stock example anyway. Surajate grinate cha, the example given is the urnana, spider. So what's different between the spider and the pot maker is the pot maker has to go outside for the clay. The spider doesn't have to go anywhere for the material for the web. So the material comes from the spider itself. So at first glance, it looks like the spider is a better metaphor for creator than pot maker, which is why we don't pray to... Oh, I could get real sarcastic with this. You know, religions pray to God in different ways. So our Christian friends will begin, "Our Father who art in heaven." That's nice, because we can look upon Bhagavan as a father. Of course, why not our Father alone can't give rise to anything, so it must be father and mother, but Christians mother gets left off. So it's simply "Our Father who art in heaven." Now, notice Hindus, we don't pray our pot maker who art in heaven, or our Nor do we pray our heavenly spider. Because there's a problem with the spider metaphor. That spider is a drishtanta. It's a metaphor that explains one thing, but it also shows another problem. Certainly the spider is a better metaphor than the pot maker, because a spider is indeed the possessor of both the upadana and nimitta karana. But there's a huge glaring defect in that spider analogy. And the defect, if you've heard these teachings before, you know this well. The defect is that the spider's creation is separate from the spider, and this universe is non-separate from its creator. Big change, big difference. So the spider solves one problem, but then introduces another. So now it gets really tricky. How can we understand a creator who is both the source of the material and the knowledge, and whose creation is non-separate from the creator? So the potmaker drishtanta doesn't work. Drishtanta means analogy. Every drishtanta is limited. Every analogy is not exactly correct. If it were exactly correct, it wouldn't be an analogy, right? So every analogy, every metaphor, every drishtanta has a defect. The potmaker, we saw the defect. The spider has a defect. So we introduce one more drishtanta. Again, it's still a metaphor, but it's better than the other two. And it happens to be the final metaphor given by the ancient rishis, and it'll finally explain the word manasa. That's what all of this discussion is about. And a final metaphor, as many of you know, is the swapna drishtanta. It's a metaphor of the dream. Because, so when you dream, you are a creator of sorts. If you dream of a house, if you dream of your parents' house, suppose, turn this up. If you dream of your parents' house, that house is made of brick and stone and plaster? No. It's made of your own mental stuff. Huh. It's manasa. When you dream of that house is manasa. It's born of your mind. You are the upadana karana. You are the material cause for that house that you dream about. And certainly you are the nimitta karana, because it comes from your memory, comes from your experience. So for that house, you are the nimitta and upadana karana for your parents' house that you dream about. And that house, is it separate from you in your dream? It actually exists within you. The house in your dream exists within you. This is the best metaphor we have to understand Bhagavan as creator. Just as when you dream, you are the source of the knowledge. Can you dream about something that you've never experienced? You can kind of put things together. You know, somebody says, "Oh, Swamiji, I dreamt about aliens." All right. Well, you've seen some movies, and also we can in dreams combine one thing of this and what, like, you know, the body of an insect and the head of a something. We do this, but can you dream? Let's see. To use Pooja Swami Dayananda's example, can you dream about Gaga Bugais? You can't dream about Gaga Bugai because you have no idea what is a Gaga Bugai. You can only dream about that which you have knowledge of, that which you've experienced, correct? In one way or the other. So, for your dream world, you are the nimitta karana. For your dream world, you are the upadana karana. Whatever it's made of you, your mind stuff. And your dream creation is non-separate from you. It's within you. This is the metaphor we use. So Bhagavan is a source of the material because of which this universe exists. Bhagavan is a source of the knowledge with which this whole universe is assembled. We live in a highly intelligent, orderly universe. Bhagavan is a source of that knowledge. Some atheists say, no, why do you need to introduce Bhagavan? It's all nature. Nature just assembles itself like this. Nature assembles itself through laws of nature. Nature assembles itself into cells and plants and human beings. Well, there's no doubt that nature is intelligent enough to assemble. like that. The only question we would ask is, how did nature get to be so intelligent? Absolutely, nature is intelligent. Who will deny that? DNA is so intelligent that imagine you started off in life as one cell. Huh? Your life started as one cell. Look at yourself in the mirror now. How does that happen? How does that one cell differentiate itself into so many different kinds of cells, so many organs? And fortunately, they're all in the right places. There's You can imagine the alternatives. How does that happen? Fine, through the miracle that we call DNA, nature is incredibly intelligent. Fine, that doesn't mean God doesn't exist, because we'd simply say, where did that intelligence come from? Laws of nature. Fine, laws of nature is intelligence. Where does that come from? Where do the laws of nature come from? And where does the stuff of the universe come from? That's why we come to this teaching. Notice how rational this is. And this is a very important comment. And let's just make it briefly before we continue. Many other religious traditions, notably the what are called Abrahamic faiths, the religions based on the Bible, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, they are primarily faith-based traditions. That is, they give you things to believe with regard to religion and with regard to deity, and they don't offer much by way of explanation. The emphasis is on belief and not on understanding. In fact, the Protestant religions are famous for saying through faith alone, and they emphasize that word alone, through faith alone you will be saved. It's actually deprecating knowledge, unfortunately. What I find a relief and what was so important to me as a young person is finding a tradition that didn't tell me what to believe. Finding a tradition that invited me to understand. If you know, people ask Swamiji why you weren't raised in India, how did you come to this spiritual tradition? This is how. As a young man, I had no religion. I felt the absence of religion in my life. At the same time, I was trained in engineering and science, and I didn't want a religion to shove. This is how it looked to me. I didn't want a religion to shove some belief system down my throat. And then when I discovered the teachings of the ancient rishis, I found a tradition that doesn't make me believe anything, doesn't tell me to believe anything, but offers me a systematic way of understanding. And that's what we're talking about right now. Okay, enough said. So, coming back to this, manasaha iti vikyataha. The source of the universe is called here manasa, and now we get the idea much better. It is as though, notice those words, as though the universe is Bhagavan's dream. I said as though for a very important reason. That is a metaphor. This universe is not a dream. Dream is a metaphor to help us understand the dream. And the reason we use the dream is that the dream creation is non-separate from the dreamer. The dreamer is a source of both material and a knowledge, and in exactly these ways. The source of this creation is a source of both material and knowledge, and this creation is non-separate from the creator, just like a dream. So it is as if Bhagavan dreamt, and as if this universe came to be. And we studied Taittiriya Upanishad recently, and it says, so kamayata bahusyam prajayeti satapas taptyata satapas tapt Yeshua, it talks about creation. And it talks about it in very mental terms, mind-related terms. Saha akamayata. He desired what? Bahu syama. May I become many. This is how it says in one Upanishad, Taittiriya Upanishad. He desired, may I become memory. Hey, those are thoughts. Manasa. So, universe is called Manasa. I'm sorry, the source of the universe is called here Manasa to help us understand how it came about. It's as though born of God's mind. It is as though Bhagavan dreams and creates a universe within himself. Now, just before we move on, the commentator, this Nilakanta, in this very Vedantic commentary, this is already a fairly deep chapter, and then the commentator gets much deeper. Sattva asattva bhyam aniryuktam ashakyat. And the commentator observes something amazing about the universe, which also takes place in the mind. Things which are utterly dissimilar don't mix. Can you mix air and dirt? Yeah, oil and water. I know if you mix enough, you can get anything to mix. But if we pick things that are utterly dissimilar, they don't seem to mix. White and black. You can mix colors. So white and black, I guess. These metaphors don't work, do they? You're thinking, Swamiji, white and black makes gray. Yes. Well, here, the commentator talks about the most dissimilar things possible. What are the most dissimilar things? He says, sattva asattva. Sentient and insentient. Consciousness and matter. How's that for dissimilar? Stuff. Stuff, solid, has mass, have weight. Contrast that with consciousness. Consciousness, that by which your thoughts are known right now. That's our definition of consciousness. How do you know what you're thinking right now? How do you know what you're experiencing right now? The answer to that question is consciousness, chit, chaitanya, chetana. This is consciousness. Now, can you mix up, what does it mean to mix consciousness and matter? Put them in a mixie. Spin it around. What comes out? Oddly enough, what comes out are you and me. Because we are a combination of matter and consciousness, right? Now, how do you get two such unlikely things to mix? It just seems so unlikely. You can imagine mixing matter with matter. You can imagine consciousness with consciousness. But how do you get these two to mix? Ask a scientist about emulsifiers. I'm not going to talk about it. Emulsifiers, that which makes the unmixable mix. Sattva asattva bhyam aniryuktam. These two are aniryuktam. They can't be combined. Aniryuktam ashakyat. It's not possible to mix them. But ajnana utpannam. Due to ignorance, they get mixed up. Due to ignorance, the combination of jada and chetana takes place. Due to ignorance? Well, ignorance here refers to, as a human being, because of ignorance, you're subject to karma and reincarnation. Right? Because of ignorance, you're born again. When you're born with this combination of chit and jada, sentient and unsentient. So the commentator says, because of Ajnana, and then I'll explain this. Let me just finish reading this. Tatcha chit pratibimbita vishishtam manasa nama jagata mula karanam.
All right.
Because of ignorance, you get a birth as a human being wherein jada and chit come together. The commentator is using this as a metaphor for creation of the universe. The universe is also this improbable combination of stuff and intelligence, which don't seem to mix very well. It's interesting to reflect. Is there any rule that says that the universe... We said before that nature is very intelligent. Is there a rule that says nature must be intelligent? Suppose nature weren't so intelligent. Suppose after the Big Bang, we'll look, put a scientific spin on this. After the Big Bang, everything just blew apart. Suppose the laws of nature were a little different and it just kept going. 14 billion years ago, it banged and that was it. And the universe is just particles flying apart from each other, which means no stars, no planets, no people. Suppose we lived in a universe where particles were just random particles. They just bounced around each other. Possible, right? There's no rule that says that the universe must be so intelligent. There is something that makes universe, matter, energy, very intelligent in the way it combines. This is what the commentator is hinting at by looking at our birth. And the metaphor, and this is very Vedantic, so just 2 minutes on this and then we'll continue with our text. It's a metaphor between the creation of a human being and the creation of the universe. The creation of a human being, oddly enough, takes place due to ignorance. And in many places, ignorance is called the most creative thing in the world. How can ignorance be the most creative thing in the world? Due to ignorance, you can create anything. You can create, the examples given is due to ignorance, you can create a world full of Vandyaputras. Vandyaputra is a son who was never born. The son of a barren woman is usually how it's translated. The son of a mother who never gave birth. Also, a world full of, what is that? Sashanka. Rabbits. Rabbits with horns. These are the stock examples. You say, Swamiji, there can't be a rabbit with horns. Wait a minute, I can imagine one. Ignorant. Swamiji, there can't be a person who was born from a mother who never gave birth. I can imagine. This is ignorance. Ignorance has this capacity to create the impossible. It's true. Ignorance has the power to create that which is otherwise impossible. For example, in your dreams, have you ever flown? It's a common dream. You fly. Because in your dream, you're ignorant about the law of gravity in that situation. Therefore, you can... See? Ignorance is very powerful. Ignorance is very creative. Ignorance in your dream can make you fly. Ignorance can make you dream, make you think about rabbits with horns. Ignorance in human form can cause the impossible to connect jada and chit, physical and conscious. Well, this metaphor then is used, he comes up, chit pratibimbita chaitanya. What is he saying? Not chit. He said, sorry, said, he said, yeah, chit pratibimbita vishishta manasaha nama jagat mulakaranam. He said, in the same way, the source of all must have some tremendous creative power to endow, to bring together matter and consciousness, and to bring them together in an intelligent manner, in an orderly manner, in a manner that stars and planets can exist, human beings can exist. This implies a creative capacity that's unfathomable, an unfathomable creative capacity. Scriptures say, in the beginning, there was only one truth. Brahman. But then, how did that one Brahman, one undifferentiated Brahman, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, partless, free from distinction, nirguna, nirakara, how did that one Brahman give rise to this entire universe of name and form? Where did that creative capacity come from? That creative capacity is the most amazing thing, and so we give it the appropriate name. Anyone can figure out what is the name we're coming up to? A creative capacity that is beyond our understanding. A creative capacity that's the most amazing, mysterious power we've ever seen, and a name for that is Maya. You know, when Maya is used in vernacular language, it gets used in lots of other ways, but in Vedanta, Maya means the creative capacity because of which that one Brahman can become manifest as this incredible, intelligent universe. And we could say, just as ignorance is in your mind, we can say metaphorically, Maya is in Bhagavan's mind. We can say that Bhagavan wields Maya. Better to say Ishvara. Ishvara, the God of the cosmos, wields Maya. Just as you use ignorance to fly in your dreams, we could say that Ishvara, the Lord of the universe, wields Maya, this incredible creative capacity, to create the universe. This happens to be a very technical subject matter, just touching on it because of this word manasa, which, as I said, even in the last class, it's shocking to see that word manasa here, because it's a very complicated word in what appears to be a fairly simple section, but this chapter does get rather philosophical. Anyway, we now understand why Bhrigu started describing the source of the cosmos as Manasa, the one who wields that capacity of Maya, that creative capacity of Maya, and just as you create a dream, you being the source of the material and knowledge, in the same way, Ishvara wields that creative capacity of Maya to create a cosmos, and just as your dream is non-separate from you, within you, in the same way, this cosmos, non-separate from Bhagavan, inside of Bhagavan, so to speak. Okay, let's proceed. Avyakta hiti vikyataha, avyakta hiti. Shashvato taksharo vyayaha, shashvato kya. Yata srishtani bhutani, yata srishtani. Jayante cha mriyanti cha, jayante cha. So, talking about the source of all, talking about the creator, avyaktaha iti vikyataha. Now we're getting more of these technical terms. Manasa was a technical term, now another technical term. Avyaktaha iti vikyataha. The source of all is vikyata, well known, is famous. It's famous for being avyakta. Avyakta, unmanifest, not manifest. Avyakta iti vikyata. unmanifest. What does that mean? Not having physical form, but more than that. That which has no physical form, it is just to show you how bad logic can be. Somebody, if you define avyakta as not having physical form, well, then I could say that the apple I'm holding in my hand is avyakta. Huh? Clearly, it has no physical form. If I throw it at you, you won't feel a thing. Wrong definition. Avyakta is that which can become vyakta. Unmanifest is that which can become manifest. This apple in my hand will never become manifest. Avyakta is that which can become manifest. And you all understand from other teachings that this universe goes through cycles of being manifest and unmanifest. Right now, the universe is vyakta, manifest. A point will come when it becomes avyakta, unmanifest. And here it says that the creator is at, in the second line, yataha, from whom, srishtani bhutani jayante, all the things that are created, srishtani bhutani, all these things, jayante, are born of that one, muriyante cha, and die unto that one. And to make it very clear, we need only return to the dream metaphor. If you're dreaming about your parents' home, so before your dream, that home was already present in your mind in an unmanifest manner. It was already here, avyakta, in your memory, correct? Your parents' home is already here in an avyakta avastha, in an unmanifest manner in your memory. And then when you dream about your parents' home, the avyakta memory becomes vyakta, manifest in your experience, in your dream world. And then when you wake up, the vyakta becomes avyakta. Doesn't that sound like a great metaphor? This is why the rishis used this to help us understand about creation. So just as your dream creation comes, it becomes manifest, and then it becomes unmanifest once again when you dream and when you wake up. In the same way for this cosmos, srishtani bhutani jayante, all these things come into existence and then go out of existence. They arise from the avyakta. They become vyakta for a period of time and again become avyakta. But the one from whom all this comes is Shashvata. That one doesn't come and go. Shashvata, eternal. Eternal, aksharaha, avyayaha, all these words mean the same thing. Shashvata means eternal. Ata akshara, undecaying. Avyayaha, not declining. The connection between these words, you should know. Eternal, the only thing that can be eternal is that which doesn't change. How does that sound to you? It's just an interesting, it's interesting. We don't think of it in these terms. That which is eternal must be unchanging. Anything that changes is not eternal. Because anything that changes stops being what it was a moment ago. So milk stops being milk when it becomes yogurt. It changes. Anything that undergoes change is not eternal. So the source of all is Shashvata avyakta, Shashvata. Is Shashvata aksharaha avyayaha, is unchanging. That is, when you dream, you remain the same person. And if you dream of going to India, your body is still laying in the bed. You don't really change. This is the idea that Ishvara, the source of all, undergoes no change whatsoever, even as this changing universe unfolds, as the changing universe arises and passes away. Okay. That's pretty good. Let us proceed. Now we get into the next topic. And the next topic is, okay, how did it work? How does it work? How does creation take place? And we have a very delightful explanation here. Let's see how he says. So sraja pratamam devo, so sraja pratamam dev, mahantam nama namataha, mahantam nama, akashamiti vikyatam, akashamiti vikyat, sarva bhuta dara prabhum, sarva. Okay. Saha asrajat, he created. Who created? Devaha, that God, that Bhagavan, that Ishvara. He created asrajat, he created pratamam, first. What was the first thing he created? And now we got another one of these obscure technical terms. The first thing he created was mahantam is in the accusative case. The word is mahat. He first created mahat. Now, unless you are a great scholar of Sankhya Darshana, this is probably unfamiliar to you. At the time of the Mahabharata, there was a prevailing philosophy that everyone studied this one philosophical system. The name of that philosophical system was Sankhya Darshana. That was the name of the philosophy. Sankhya was, I hesitate to call it a spiritual system, more of a philosophical way of understanding the world. And it attempted to show how the universe came into existence, just like science. Thousands of years ago, science as we understand didn't exist. So we didn't know anything about big bangs and atoms and molecules in those days. So the ancient rishis devised a system of philosophy. They devised it based not on scientific experimentation. They devised it based on their own mind and insights. And in that system of philosophy, in a system specifically known as Sankhya, they came up with their, I guess you'd call it a flow chart of how the universe came to be. Just as if you look in a science book, they'll say, oh, first there was a Big Bang, and then as it cooled down, then there was a formation of particles, protons, electrons, etc. And then as it cooled down some more, then we got hydrogen atoms, then cooled down some more, and we eventually got clouds of gas. And they give you this whole timeline in modern science of how the universe began with the Big Bang. Well, according to this philosophy called Sankhya, the first thing that comes from the source of all, we'll just call it, to avoid putting a name on it, we'll just draw an om there. They said first came, let me just do it a little Vedantically. So we say that Ishvara, with the power of Maya, the first evolute, the first thing to come forth is Prakriti. Now this is as envisioned by this philosophy called Sankhya. Prakriti means nature, not nature is what you look outside and see the outside the window, the trees and the sky and all that. Prakriti in a very fundamental sense, the possibility for nature. Then, just as the flowchart in a science book says, what came next, then what came next. So what came next, according to Sankhya, is Mahat. We're going to go through this fairly quickly because I don't know about you. I find plain philosophy extremely boring. And Sankhya is a philosophy, and if you want to get bored, go buy some books on Sankhya. I think you'll get bored. I will get bored. All right. And we'll explain this as briefly as possible so we can move on. But the text uses these terms. Little insight. So this was the prevalent philosophical system at the time the Mahabharata was written. So we shouldn't be surprised to find references to the prevailing philosophy embedded in the Mahabharata. So Mahat could be seen as buddhi, intellect, but not an individual intellect, like a cosmic mind. If Prakriti is a potential for nature, nature in an unmanifest form, Mahat is a first evolute of it, and its cosmic mind, the potential for creation, intelligence. Maybe nice to give a metaphor, since we just looked at the mind. So this is, Ishvara is equivalent to you, the dreamer. Prakriti is when you're asleep. When you're asleep, the possibility of dream is there. It's not there yet, but it's potentially there in your sleep. And then, when you wake up a little bit and start dreaming, your buddhi, your intelligence, your memories come into play. And that's why you're able to dream. So this is like a metaphor to describe creation in terms of our own dreams. So Mahat, let us call it this cosmic intelligence, which can give rise to the universe. So our present verse says, Saha Asrajat Pratamam Devaha, the first thing that shining God created, Devaha. The first thing that was created was Mahantam, Mahat. Nama Namataha, that which is called Mahat by name. And then, Akasham Iti Vikyataha Sarva Bhuta Dharaha Prabhu. Then comes Akasha, actually. It's funny because it doesn't quite follow Sankhya. If any of you follow Sankhya very carefully, the next evolute is actually Ahankara, if you have studied all those texts. And here we find something a little different. We'll actually come to Ahankara a little later. He says the next thing to come is Akasha. Space, akasha, akasham iti vikyata. Next comes space, which is sarva bhuta dharaha, that which supports all things, that which gives place to all things. If there were no space, where would I put my glasses? So there must be a space in order to put anything. So sarva bhuta dharaha. Prabhu here can also have the meaning of being all-pervasive. Vibhu, Prabhu. It's that all-pervasive space. Now, it's as though when you're dreaming, first you have sleep, the potential for dream, then your intelligence, buddhi, and then comes, I suppose, if you're going to dream of your parents' home, you first have to have some place to put your parents' home. So you must create some kind of space in your dream. Some kind of space. You create a mental space. And here, Akasha. Space. And not just Akasha. Now it gets interesting, though.
Akashadabhavadvari, Akashadabhavadvari, Salilad Agnimarutau, Salilad Agnimarutasam Yogat, Agni Maruta Samyog Tata Samabhavam Mahi Ata Samabhavam.
So, first comes from Mahat, from this cosmic mind, the first element to get created is Akasha. And then Akashat, from the element of space, Abhavat, there was born what? Vari, water. Salila, water. They both mean water. Huh? How does that work? If any of you have studied Sankhya thoroughly and even Vedanta, you know, Panchi Karana, you have space and then comes air, right? Then fire, then water, then earth. This is the usual sequence of the five elements. Well, we're going to see these five elements in a very different order. So this verse clearly says, Akashat, from space, comes what? Vari, water. And then Salilat. Salila is another word for water. Salilat, from water, comes what? Agni and Marut. Agni, fire, and Marut, wind. And that au ending is dual. So from water come fire and air, Marut. And then Agni Maruta Samyogat, due to the combination of fire and air, Agni Maruta Samyogat, due to the combination Tataha, from that, Samabhavan, what arises is Mahi, earth. I bet you've never seen that before. Now, this is fascinating. Many of you have seen in classical texts, including the texts on Sankhya, you've seen the usual order in which the elements get created is from the least dense, Akasha, and then going to the next, Vayu, air, leading to the next, Agni, fire, leading to water, Apa, leading to the final earth, Prithivi. If you've studied some Vedanta or Sankhya, this is probably much more familiar to you. Now, let's have fun with this, because there's an important point. Which one is right? And this will challenge you. Which one of these is right? Some texts say that the evolution of elements is in this way. Most Vedanta Acharyas will say this. Most Sankhya Acharyas will say this. But then here, we have in the Mahabharata, in this dialogue between Bhishma and Yudhishthira, who's quoting no less a figure than Bhrigu, and he gives the most unusual, you know, from space comes water, from water comes both fire and air, and then fire and air combine and give you earth. You've never seen that before. I've never seen it before until I read this chapter. So now when I ask this question, which is right, this will force us to deal with something that's significant about scriptures. Is the Mahabharata a science book? Not a science book, is it? It's a book of spiritual wisdom. It's a book that tells a story and teaches us spiritual wisdom. It's not a book on science. If we were to look upon it as a science book, we'd get pretty confused, right? But suppose we understand it's a book of spiritual wisdom that makes reference to science. And some of the references are one way, some of the references are other, because in ancient times, they weren't so rigid about how they understood science. In modern times, we're very rigid. We say that, you know, one oxygen plus two hydrogens give you water. And there's no, you know, you can't play around with it. It's just the way it is. So in modern times, because science has become so precise, we're used to very rigid portrayal of scientific truths. But in ancient times, it wasn't so rigid. It was much more flexible. Therefore, be ready for many different expressions. In fact, who said five elements? I think it's in Chandogya Upanishad where you find Trivit Karana. You find a universe consisting of three elements. You thought there were five. Another Upanishad says three. And then science books will say over 100. Who's right? Ask the scientists. This is not a science class. And what I would encourage you to do is when you're studying any scripture, differentiate in your mind. Any reference to science cannot be understood as we do in modern times. So the ancient view of science and modern view of science is very different. There's even a more important point underlying this. The context now is how the universe came into existence. And what's significant is that this order of events is very different from the order of events followed or shown in other texts. In other Upanishads and other scriptures, you'll find a different account of creation. In fact, if you look at enough scriptures, you will find dozens and dozens of accounts of how creation took place, and all of them are different. What shall we make of that? In fact, can we just... One more verse, and then to make this point very vividly. So far we've got the elements coming about, and now look at this one last verse. Tatas tejo mayam divyam, tatas tejo mayam, padmam srishtam swayam bhuva, padmam srishtam swayam, tasmad padmat samabhavad. Tasmad pamat samabhavad brahma vedamayo nidhi. Brahma vedan nidhihi. Good. Tataha, from those five elements, or maybe thereafter, after the creation of those five elements, then what arises is a tejomayam divyam padmam, is srishtam. What is srishtam, what comes into creation, is a divyam padmam, a divine lotus, which is tejomayam, shining, a shining divine lotus, and which is swayambhuva, which is self-created as a result of the existence of these five elements and as a result of the existence of Mahat. And tasmat padmat, from that lotus, from that shining divine lotus, from that lotus, tasmat padmat samabhavat, there comes into existence Brahma, Brahmaji, who is Vedamayaha, the one who embodies the four Vedas, the one who's a nidhi, the abode for the Vedas, abode for the entire universe. How is it we've suddenly switched over to some mythological story here? And this is obviously a reference to, you know, the Bhagavad Purana story. Mahavishnu lies on the bottom of the Milky Ocean, sound asleep, and from his navel comes a lotus, and that lotus blooms, and Brahmaji. What in the world is going on in this text? This is fascinating. And what what we can see is a whole variety of creation stories. Let's call them what they are, creation myths. These are myths. They're not facts. This is not science. This is, nor is this a systematic description about how the universe came. This is one of many, many creation myths. And there's a very important point to be seen right here. Our friends who followed the Bible receive from that Bible a central creation story. God created the world in 6 days, rested on the seventh. And because there's only one story, they take it as being fact, right? Many Christians actually try to put a date. If God created the world in 6 days, they go through all the dates in the Bible, and they figure out that the first day where God started his act of creation, they'll put a date on it, some 10,000 years ago or some number. They actually come up with a number for that. And they say, on this date, some 4,000 B.C. or 6,000 B.C., I think 4,000 something B.C. is a date many will use. This is a day when creation got started. Isn't that a little silly? But isn't that what happens when you take a mythological story too seriously? And it's easy to take a mythological story seriously if it's the only story you've got. What we find in Mahabharata and other scriptures are a great variety of creation stories, creation mythologies, which means you can't take any of them seriously. That's the wrong expression. You can't take any of them as being factual accounts of how creation took place. They're all different, which means they're all meant to teach us something, but not teach us about elements. This isn't a science class. It's not a book on science. So the purpose of Mahabharata here is not to teach us about what element came first and what element came second. The purpose of this is to show that all that exists, the universe that we know, comes from one creator. The details you can make up in any way you want, don't hold on to that. The details are for the study of science. Let the scientists tell us what the details are. Here, the Mahabharata and our other texts want us to understand that all that exists comes from one creator. If you look at this passage and find it confusing and jumbled, the tendency would be to look upon that as a defect of this tradition. I see it as a glory of this tradition. Honestly, I see this as being the greatest glory of this tradition, because if this were like the biblical tradition and you did get one creation story, we would all be clinging on to that one creation story as if it were scientific fact, and that would be then we would be like some of our Christian friends, one of whom says that not only did the world begin some 8,000 years ago, but this one guy has a date for the end of the world. Having gone through all the dates in the Bible, this very famous preacher today says that the world is going to end. By the way, get ready, it's ending next year. He says that. It's ending in April of next year. You have almost exactly 1 year to go. It's ending in April sometime. Of course, I think some years ago he said the world was going to end, but apparently he found out that he made some mistakes in his calculations. So he's recalculated, and now he knows that the world is going to end in April. Now, that kind of silliness can arise if we only have one creation story and we take it too seriously. We have scriptures full of varied stories. No two stories tell it the same way. And you can call it a confusing jumble, but in this case, that confusing jumble is indeed a glory of the scriptures, because it really prevents us from misinterpreting this as being science. So when we meet next time, we'll continue with our text and understanding who and what is the source of all this. A couple of important announcements. Oh, very happy to announce that we're starting to plan for our 10th anniversary celebration. It's amazing that we're already 10 years. So our 10th anniversary celebration will take place here on Saturday, June 5th. You can mark your calendars. We put some flyers out. Also, we'll be bringing out a souvenir again on this occasion. Many of you